When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 182. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading up to the northwest of England, to Cumbria, to talk to farmer and calf buyer Liz Hogarth. Liz, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Very, very well. I'm excellent. I've just been away for a few days with my girls. Hopefully we'll be into harvesting wheat in a few days, and I'm talking to you. What could be better?
Don't know about the talking to me bit. One thing I will say, though, having listened to previous podcasts, is they must normally be done at night. I know you said evening there. And everyone seems to have a glass of wine or some kind of alcoholic beverage. But at 9 a.m, am I allowed that? So, in true Liz style, as most people probably know, I love my porn star martini cocktails. So I brought myself a Graham's Dairy passion fruit yogurt, because I swear they taste just like a porn star martini. This is no advertisement for Robert. Sorry, Robert, it's not. But so this is my non-alcoholic cocktail.
That's absolutely fab. Well, I'm very boring. I've just got water, but I'll pretend it's general vodka. Is the sun shining up there in Cumbria? Always shines in Cumbria, doesn't it?
Well, no. It's raining. It's windy. The sun comes out for a few minutes and then it pours down. So it's okay. Typical Lake District weather, really, at the moment. But my grass is growing, which is excellent for second crop. So it's all good.
Yeah, typical British summer. Okay, an advert to read out for Bayer. You can win a takeaway for you and your team this harvest, courtesy of Bayer. Simply nominate your cab warrior, that teammate who goes above and beyond. Tell us why they deserve to win by tagging them and Bayer in a tweet, or enter via the competition Instagram post. Two teams will win each week during harvest. Full details on the Bayer for Crops UK social media accounts. And I think that's a brilliant thing at the moment. Long hours on the tractor. What could be better than having a pizza delivered? Liz, you're up in Cumbria. Is that where you were born and raised?
Yeah, so I was born and grew up in a tiny village in Cumbria. We are part of the Yorkshire Dales National Park, but we're also on the edge of the Lake District. So, born a few years ago, 40-something years ago.
Like me, 40-something years ago. So is that where the family have always been? Have you got deep roots, sir?
Yeah, deep roots, probably from about, it's not something I've ever looked into, but certainly I would say seven generations.
Wow.
The farm initially was farmed by my great uncle, so my grandma on my paternal side's brother. A lot of the farm here was owned by an estate one person. So we bought strips of farm. So our farm, it consists of 500 acres and it's seven farms, I think, in one. So the farms would run from river to the top of the fell to meet the valley at the opposite side. So, he slowly bought those farms up in a really good block together. So it's a really lovely hill farm.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's such a fascinating landscape up there, isn't it, that part?
Yeah.
Typical farm childhood. Did you grow up sort of outdoors, running around?
Yeah. I was a complete tomboy. I loved my BMX. I probably, I don't know, before I could even touch the floor, Dad had me going around the cows. So we were a dairy farm up until 4.5 years ago. He'd have me going around the cows in the summer on the motorbike to bring them in. But I couldn't touch the floor. This was a Fantic 250. Like, it's not a small bike by any means, big, heavy bike. And this is going to make Stuart Roberts' head explode, because there's no health and safety whatsoever. Sorry, Stuart. He would set off with me on the front and then jump off the back, and I'd go round and round and round in circles in second gear, and then I'd have to drive up to him and he'd kind of catch the clutch and the handlebars. No health and safety. Then that led to
me. It was the 80s though, wasn't it?
It was the 80s. Yeah. There was no health and safety. And that sort of led to me then dragging the Fantic 250 out of the barn, pushing it down to what we would call the cooling house where the bulk tank was,
yeah,
trying to kickstart this motorbike. No, Dad was not in sight. I just had no fear. Like, the faster and the higher I could jump on that motorbike, the better. I look back now and I would never let my daughter do this. Not in a million years, ever. But I've just got no fear.
Yeah, brilliant. So happy childhood then, growing up.
Yeah, really happy. Mum and Dad split up when I was five. So weekends would be spent with Dad on the farm and sure, with my great uncle. And yeah. Like, I couldn't ask for more. Both of my parents remarried, both had more children. So all in all, I'm the eldest of five brothers and two sisters. When you put the whole, we're not a very conventional family, but
no one's got a conventional family anymore.
What is
a conventional family?
I don't know. So we range. So I'm 41 and my youngest brother is 19. I always get this mixed up. Yes. Or 20. Oh Lord, there's that many of them. I can't remember.
Yeah. So I guess what's coming across is you grew up on the farm with lots of family members around and very sort of safe and secure childhood.
Yeah, lots of great aunties and great uncles. Yeah. And my great uncle Jimmy, who owned the farm, would take us down to Bridge North in Shropshire, where my grandparents lived, and we'd probably go down there twice a year.
Yeah, okay.
We'd go in the Land Rover. It would take 3.5 hours, which it didn't need to. But he'd like to sit. We'd sit in the Land Rover with bacon sandwiches that he'd made that morning in 4-week-old fat that had sat on the top of the Rayburn, eat cheese and onion crisps, and drink Tizer. Yeah, so yeah, no, great memories. I'm lucky.
Yeah, and your granddad was a big influence on you.
Yeah, granddad was a real worker. So he had a farm and a mill and an animal feed business. Yeah, and like the strongest man you would know. Like, he could carry two of those 25-kilo sacks of potatoes up the yard when he came to visit and just not even break a sweat. He loved cricket, he loved rugby, and he just worked and worked and worked. And that's been a real, big influence on me as well. So, yeah. And he's a great family man. Like, he would always keep us all together and have family parties. And, you know, when he came up, there'd be a sly £20 passed across the table. You know, don't tell your grandma.
granddad's great like that, aren't they?
Yeah.
So tell us about your brothers and sisters. You said you got four of them, yeah?
Five brothers. Two sisters. We've got Thomas is my full brother, although I never tell anybody anything other than my brothers and sisters.
Yeah, sure.
He's just qualified as a retained fireman, so he's on call doing that, and he's a warehouse manager at a local town. Lord, there's loads of them. And then we've got Claire and Sean from my mum's side. Claire is a dental nurse and she lives in the Isle of Man. So she was over last week to see us. I've not seen her for 2 years. So that was great. And she brought my niece and my nephew with her. Sean works at a garage in Kendal. Then we've got Wayne, I don't know how to describe Wayne. I love him to bits, but like, money burns a hole. He's me when I was his age. Money burns a hole in his pocket. He wants to do everything, see everything. And he works for Macmillan. James is back at uni in Leeds. So he's gone back to uni, having had a few years off school. And Joe, actually, I know we'll talk about my sister later on, but after losing my sister, didn't really know, he was still at school, didn't really know what he wanted to do. Was taken on as apprentice by a solar panel company and is just doing brilliantly. Loves his job and is just one of the happiest-go-lucky guys you'll ever meet. You know, he's brilliant. So lots of pride in all of my siblings.
Yeah, I can tell. So when you were growing up, what did you want to be on the farm? Did you want to be a farmer? Or
I was always told at school, you're much too clever to do that. Yeah. Now, I don't think I'm that clever. I only retain 20% of the information in my head that I need to do. The other 80% is just out there somewhere. And I did well at school. I didn't try. School was not a great part of my life. I didn't have very good experiences at school for one reason and another. I left. I went to sixth form. Absolutely hated it. Mm-hmm. And after 3 months, I just thought, this is not for me at all. I had a part-time job in the local pub, so I went there and I worked full-time. But that wasn't... That was fine, but I wanted to do something. I wanted to meet people. I mean, it's a tiny village where I live, and I'd not really experienced the world. So I went to work for a life and pensions company in about 1999, I think. Okay. And that opened my eyes, like, oh, there's other people. And, for them, I then went to work in Edinburgh for 6 months. Absolutely loved that, met some brilliant people. And as people will know from Twitter, I've got a real love for Scotland. It's where I would really love to be eventually, if I can be, if my daughter allows me to ever leave here. And then from there, I went to work for a financial advisor and did a couple of years there, but never really got me sort of going, you know, like mm-hmm. got me excited. And then I sort of fell into a job working in a children's home. So working with boys who had EBD, they were out of school, sort of naughty boys is what you would call them. Absolutely love that. Like, you didn't know whether you were going to go into the lads being quiet and just wanting miss, will you come and play football, which I did. I took my football boots, or they were going to be rioting. And I loved it. They were brilliant. And it was hard, but it was so rewarding. And then I had my daughter. So I came back to the family farm once I had her. That was in 2006.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, I guess, I suppose what comes across there is that you are a people person. You like being with people, with children, with adults, and working with everybody.
Yeah, really, I am a people person, and I'm not a homebody. I don't need to be at home.
Yeah.
I could just be anywhere and it wouldn't bother me.
Hmm. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, so tell us about your daughter.
Eva, well, boy, did she shock me. So she was born in 2006 after 16 hours of labour and an emergency section. Don't know how much you want to know here.
Gee whiz.
Out came this 10-pound, 1-ounce baby. Mm-hmm. And I like looked at her and she was like a toddler. Yeah. To me, she was a boy. She was always going to be a boy. There was no question. And then she was a girl. And boy, did she turn my world upside down. Like, you know, my dad always said, I never, ever thought someone would boss you. Like, you've always been the boss of the family. But, you know, she has got you wrapped around her little finger. And she absolutely has. She's great. We've had a few issues over the last few years. I won't go into them too much, but Eva was diagnosed autistic. I knew she was autistic from a very early age. Mm-hmm. But I was told I was neurotic. I'd worked with autistic children, so I knew the signs. And girls are very good at masking it. And then from that, she has struggled. I think if we hadn't had COVID, it would have come to light that she'd struggled at school. And it's not because she's not clever. It's because the environment doesn't suit her.
Sure. Yeah,
and a school environment probably doesn't suit about 80% of children.
Mm-hmm. Didn't suit me.
Yeah. And I think that's something we really need to look at with the education of our children is how we teach these children in a way to make them grow.
Yeah.
So Eva is now a school refuser. So she hasn't been to school for a while and we're just getting through day by day at the moment. She's 15 on Sunday, so I've done quite well. She's 15 and she's polite and happy-ish, you know. And we're looking now at teaching her a trade, so her going to college in September and learning what she enjoys rather than having to do what she's told.
Yeah.
She seems in a much better place. At the moment. So yeah.
That's fair. But it was rough for you after she was born. Yeah, it was a difficult time.
Yeah, I mean, she wasn't an easy baby. She cried 24 hours a day. Yeah, you don't forget that.
No.
And I was diagnosed with postnatal depression. And I have always, as I said earlier, school really wasn't a positive experience for me. Mm-hmm. And I did suffer a little bit at school with depression. I was off school for a while. And then I kind of had a word with myself. I said, actually, these people are not going to ruin your life. They're not going to rule you. Mm-hmm. You need to turn this on its head. And then they left. They were a year older than me. And so my last year of school was really positive. So, yeah, it's always been there. And, you know, I just think, well, you have to deal with it. And, yeah, I mean, it's always going to be something that's there. But if I was diabetic, I'd take insulin. So, yeah. Actually, you know, why we don't need to be worrying about people who are taking antidepressants, because it's just a complete lack of chemical in your brain. Mm-hmm. And you just need help with that. So, yeah, it wasn't easy, but we got out the other end and I've got this beautiful, tall, leggy blonde in my life that forces me around. And you'll find this out soon with four daughters. They hemorrhage money. She went shopping yesterday and, oh, Lord.
I'm trying not to think about it with my girls. It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, we I think we've with sort of anxiety and depression, and you and I have talked about this before, and you know, we've both been through that, and anxiety will certainly never go away for me. But I am encouraged that, I mean, we're having this conversation now. It's kind of a mainstream conversation now, isn't it? Whereas certainly when we were growing up, it was just not a thing, was it? Maybe even more so in, well, I don't know if this is a generalization, but maybe even more so in sort of farming and rural communities, you know, you just no one was talking about it, even up till very recently, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I see my anxiety. So 2 years ago, Peter Hines, who's become a really good friend of mine, him and his wife, Paula, asked me to speak at a Rearing to Go conference that they had down in Shropshire, a mental health conference. Now, I'd not talked about my story ever, and certainly never, ever spoken about my sister. Obviously, my friends knew, local people knew, my family knew. But I've never told my story. And for me, my anxiety around doing that was so bad that I didn't think I could do it. But what I tell myself is that if I can just do this, I can turn it on its head, just stand in front of these people, just tell my story, I've won. And my anxiety demon is not just sat there pecking at my head like it does for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So I very much try and turn any negative in my life into a positive in somehow, and that's how I control it. I'm not saying that there aren't other ways to control it, because there are, and there's other things that I have to do. But I mean, to stand in front of those people and talk about my life is a big thing for me. But yeah, and I'm still not comfortable standing in front. I mean, if this was live now, I would be feeling sick and I'd be shaking. But because it's just you and I, then I'm okay with that. But not great in front of a crowd. And people say, oh, you're great, you know. And, you know, I'm always picked to speak at family members' funerals. Always me.
me too, actually.
So I can't be bad at it, but it's just my anxiety demon that's sat there, you know, making sure that I'm still thinking about him. So,
yeah. I think with me as well, it was, and this, you know, I've talked about this before, and it sounds so obvious when you say it, but for a long time, you kind of think you're the only one, don't you? Because you don't talk about it. But when you do finally open up about these things, and other people say, oh, me too, you know, and yeah, I've always felt like that. And you think, God, why didn't I talk about this sooner? You know, why didn't I realize that? It's not just me, you know, feeling like this on my own. You know, so many people do. It's not, you know, it's pretty normal, isn't it? I think
it is normal, and we need to normalize it further. You know, we need more people to talk about it. We need more people to say, actually, I am not okay. Today is a pretty crappy day. And so was yesterday. And, you know, and seek those people out. And I think what's happened, because I do talk about mental health on social media platforms like Twitter, people have engaged with me and I have had phone calls and, you know, chats. And I do see farmers who are really struggling. You know, the stories I could tell you about the times that a farmer has just had enough and is at the end of his tether. And actually, I drove down a farmer's track one day because I've not seen him for ages. I thought, I'll just pop in. And thank God I did, because, you know, he was in a bad state. And the next day I text him, said, how are you doing? And he said, much better. You've made me realise that actually it's not all as bad. So he was looking at his neighbour who had a brand new tractor and a wife and four children, while he sat at home, you know, with no wife, no children, on an old case. I can say case, I'm not massive, can I? You know, yeah. But actually the reality is that that's what he thinks, and it's not what he knows. If we all the time look at what we think we know rather than what we do know, of course those scenarios are going to play out in our head. And it's not all as pretty as it seems on the outside either.
No,
people forget that.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose social media plays a part in that as well, doesn't it? Because there's times where I've just had to get off it because I'm having a bit of a rough time and everything's going wrong, and then you can look on social media and you think, well, everyone else is doing great.
But
that's not always the case, is it? And social media isn't reality.
No, and the other side of social media is that when you think that you're doing something, so I did something last year to promote Milk Your Moments campaign and Morrison's trying to sort out the imbalance in the carcass sales. Mm-hmm. And I got really, really attacked for that. And it wasn't because my heart wasn't in the right place. It was because somebody had taken what I had said in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. Now, what I was saying wasn't that you should buy this milk or this milk. What I was saying was that I would really like the consumer to think about their choices. Mm-hmm. Because if we think about our choices, and we buy that milk that might be 10 pence a litre more, but actually it affords the dairy farmer a better a turnover, then that's sending a clear message to people, to the processors. And then they will need more of these farmers on those contracts. So what I want to do is lift the bottom line base price to the top, because I think it needs to be a fairer supply chain. Sure. And because of that, I got some really, really bad press. And I think I probably cried, and I don't cry ever, for 2 days. And I came off Twitter. I deleted the whole thing. I came off Twitter. And actually, somebody who I don't even know had called Andrew Barraclough, who's a farmer up near Penrith, and said, look, I don't think Liz is okay. You know, this has happened. I've seen what's been said. And he called me and said, you know, you need to ignore that. Abby Reader called me, Michael Oakes called me. And I thought, actually, my heart is in the right place. And if that's how they want to think, then that's fine. I need to just get over that. So, yeah, it can be a really dark place that way as well.
Yeah, but I suppose conversely, you know, and we've talked about this before. I've also had my issues with social media, but it can also be a brilliant place as well.
And it is,
you know, especially for farmers, and I mean in a sort of isolation and mental health. You know, it can literally be a lifesaver for people.
Oh, the positive far outweighs the negative. Yeah. And if that's one story out of all the years I've been on Twitter, and, you know, I can promote mental health and promote agriculture, then I can deal with that one scenario. And I'm not going to let that bother me now. That lies with them, not me.
Yeah. I think for me, when I was sort of at my worst a couple of years ago, you know, there was one or two people on social media, and I went, you know, I didn't tell people much about it at the time, but there's one or two people picked up on it that I wasn't right and got in touch with me and reached out. And I won't mention their names because they'll know who they are, but I can actually feel myself, you know, getting emotional now thinking about them, because I think those people, I don't think they'll ever realize actually what they did for me by doing that. And I think, you know, those are people who I you know, until fairly recently, I didn't know. But, you know, so it does.
You'll always be forever grateful for those people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what I say. You know, you might not really know somebody very well, or you might never have met them. If you get an inkling, I've always said, if you get an inkling that somebody's not okay, ask them. If they say yes, they're fine, ask them again, because the second answer can be very, very different to the first, and that can just change somebody's course, change their life path. And that's really, really important.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me about your sister, Cheyenne.
So Cheyenne was born in, I don't know how much you want me to tell you. Anyway, so she was born in 1997, and out came this tiny little bundle of joy in a tiny little sister for me.
So you were like, how old are you then? Like,
so I'd be 17. 17, when she was born. And just like the tiniest thing you've ever seen, and just loved her to bits. And she had this blonde, scruffy hair, and she just used to chatter non-stop, and she would have the odd tantrum, which, you know, children inevitably do.
Yes.
And just she was great. She again didn't have great experiences at school, which led to her not being. I think she did really well at secondary school, and then she went to sixth form, and then she started to really struggle, and she was off school. There's lots of things that happened it's really difficult to describe. So between the ages of 16 and 18, there's a real grey area for mental health, and we're really lacking resources, because a doctor can't prescribe antidepressants, so we couldn't get antidepressants for her. CAMHS is so overstretched, there was no support. We ended up getting private support.
I guess it is hard enough to be that age anyway, isn't it? You know, it's a really difficult age for anybody, isn't it, really?
Teenage years, you just want to skip that, don't you?
Yeah.
And there was just, she was just not happy at all. Eventually we found a private mental health facility, which had been open 9 months, and it was based on American trials, and it was meant to be really, really successful. She was really excited about that, because she spent quite a lot of time in various mental health facilities around Cumbria, you know, passed from one to the other, sent home, but we couldn't really keep her safe at home. And then literally, I think 2 weeks before she was due to go there, we'd secured the funding and everything. 2 weeks before she was due to go there, they actually closed the facility. Now, bearing in mind, this had cost millions of pounds to open and had only been open 9 months, but wasn't full. They closed it because it wasn't full, wasn't paying for itself. But the whole process between becoming diagnosed with depression or, you know, a mental illness, to getting to the stage and securing funding is so long that 9 months just isn't long enough for that place to be open. So that was a real, real setback for her. So they were talking about sending her home. Now, my memories around this time and my sister are very, very vague. And I don't know if that's something that's going on in my brain to just keep those away for now. Yeah. But she did come back, and then we found another facility, which was in York, and she was really excited about that. And she went there, but it just wasn't doing it for her. It just, she wasn't engaging, I don't think. And I think it had just gone too long, really. You know, we'd had lots of self-harm and things like that. Lots of phone calls in distress, you know, and she just wasn't. I'll just stop a minute.
Yeah, it's fine. You know, I guess, for you and your dad, you're still milking then on the farm, I guess.
Yeah, so we were still milking, but we'd actually taken the decision. So because Cheyenne was going to be, well, originally she wasn't going to be in York where she ended up ultimately. Eva was very young. So Eva was 10. So it meant, so my dad and my stepmom took the decision to sell the milk cow. So come out of milk and you have to give notice. So it, we would come out of milk on the 1st of November, I think, 19. Oh, because that's when she was born. See, my brain's gone to shit.
Well, the thing is, I suppose, with the dairy farming, and we were milking here, certainly when I was growing up, it's so intense, isn't it? You've got to milk, you know, every day, you're milking twice a day, and it's hard to. So if you've got a family member that you need to take care of, or if you've got other things you need to get away from the farm, it's incredibly difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, so it was, so basically it was 2016.
Okay.
And we're taking the decision to come out with milk. We would sell the milk cows. We'd always bred from our dairy cows with a view to Dad wanting a suckler herd. So coming out of milk eventually, so we kept a few beef replacements. So we'd made this decision because then Dad and Pat could go to York. So every weekend, there was no hassle about who was going to milk. There was no pressure on me having Eva, who was 10. And, you know, through the winter months, it's quite a big job. We only had 50 dairy cows, but it needed two of you to feed and do all the jobs. And then we've got 550 sheep, so they were to feed. So it was really just a plan in the making. Dad could do things, do a bit less. I could manage everything else. And unfortunately, you know, that placement in York broke down, and she just couldn't interact with them. I think you can maybe get to a point, and there was just, she couldn't see any further ahead of where she was in that dark place. So and a month before we sold the milk cows, she was no longer in York. She was actually on a mental health ward up in Carlisle. She succeeded in taking her own life.
I can't even begin to imagine how difficult it must have been. And I don't really know what to say. I guess there's nothing you can say to something like that, but I don't know. That getting that phone call and sort of dealing with that must have been, goes without saying, must have been the darkest moment of all of
us. And there's no one to blame here. Some people have said, well, how was she allowed to do this? Why was she left on her own? But to be one-to-one when you're depressed is no life at all. Like, we need to be making progression here. And, you know, Dad had spoken to Cheyenne the night before and she seemed really down, but he was going up to Carlisle the next day and they were going to go shopping, I think. Dad, how Cheyenne managed to do this is beyond me. I've never managed to get my dad shopping. So I should have moaned because I hate shopping, but she loved it and Dad loved taking her to Primark. That's where she loved to go. And he spoke to her the night before and she was feeling really low. And he just said, look, you know, try and get some sleep. We're coming up. We're going to take you out. We'll do whatever you want to do, you know, and we'll see you in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't how, you know, they were meant to have seen her. So they got a phone call from the hospital. I think it was early that morning. I can't really remember again. So they went up to Carlisle and Cheyenne was in intensive care. Things weren't great. And Dad rang me because I'm the eldest, so I get to tell everybody these things, obviously. The problem was I had James and Joe at home, at Dad's house. So I went up to Dad's house. He only lives a few fields away. Who were 15 and 17. Wayne was in Leeds at uni. and Thomas was down in Sedba. So I had to ring them all and get them all back so that we could go up to Carlisle. I would drive everybody there. But actually, we never got to see her because the life support needed to be switched off because there was no viable life there.
I can't imagine what you all went through in the weeks and months after then. I guess now it doesn't go away, does it?
It doesn't. The one thing, and we all say this as a family, is the one thing that we can take as a little piece of hope is that she is no longer in any pain. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that it's so very final, and you know, you've got to wonder where we could have been now. And we may have been in exactly the same position, but we can't do anything with wonder, can we? So we know that she's not in any pain. And she was in an incredible amount of pain.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose, you've all got each other. It sounds like you're incredibly close family. So you've got each other, I guess.
When the boys do as they're told, we're fine. But, you know, if they don't...
Well, yeah,
we are incredibly close. It's not. I don't think it's easy for any one of us.
No.
We have a little family WhatsApp group, which my brother Thomas has renamed from, I can't remember what it was originally, to What's Liz Up To Today, because I would always throughout time send pictures and, you know, yeah. So
I might make that the title of this podcast.
Yeah. What's Liz Up To Today? Cool. Yeah. And, you know, so, and it's difficult. It is difficult, but
yeah.
What's come out of this is my stepmom is wholeheartedly putting her life and soul into a charity called Action for Wellbeing, which is a suicide prevention charity. So what she does is she's a buddy, and the lady who runs this not-for-profit organisation has people who buddy up with people who are really struggling. So it's just really somebody to help them because there is such a lack of resources. And the hope is that they'll raise enough money that one day they can have a house so that you don't have to go straight into a mental health facility, maybe, or when you come out of that, you've got somewhere to go where you can stay with a family member, a friend, your dog, your guinea pig, whatever you need to surround you, and you have support there. And I just got a message off my dad, actually, because my stepmom is running a half marathon.
Is she? Wow.
Yeah, to raise... So she is a keen That's runner awesome. Anyway, to raise money for the... I'll read it to you. Hang on. You might have to pause here. So, yeah, she's running the Leeds half marathon. So dad basically sent a message to our group saying, Pat is skiving off to do the Leeds half marathon. And he's raising money for the charity Action for Wellbeing.
That's a very farmer thing, that is, isn't it?
It is. So Pat does the bulk of the work on the farm while dad's sat watching cricket. So,
outstanding.
Yeah, and then we found out last year that when they want to call the house that they're going to buy eventually, the Cheyenne Gardner Respite House, which is obviously Cheyenne's name. So that was a big thing. So, yeah, and she does brilliantly because she just does all these things and people bring money and it's great.
And I know you've done stuff as well with mental health charities. Mentioned it earlier. With Rearing to Go and things like that, and you know, I guess, and I don't know if this is a stupid question, but does knowing that from such an awful tragedy, does knowing that you are helping people bring a degree of comfort?
Yeah,
you
know, like from that? I said at Rearing to Go. That was the one of the most difficult things I'd ever had to do was to talk about myself and talk about my sister. But if from Cheyenne's death I can help one person and one family to not live every day or feel every day what we do, then that to me is worth it.
Yeah.
Because it's so important that it's so difficult to see people struggling.
I agree. And that's just, that's incredible what your stepmom's doing and what you do as well. I guess it's never going to go away, and that feeling of loss for you and your family. But I suppose, as you move forward, and as we've just said, helping other people and taking those steps forward, I guess that's all you can do, isn't it? You know, just keep sort of moving forward and one day at a time, I suppose.
It is. And for, you know, my sister died on the 1st of October and we finished milking at the end of that month. And you still have to get up. You still have to do those things. The cows still need to be milked. We still need to get the tups in the field. And that brought us together as a family. We had to do that. Every day you had to get out of bed and do those things. And I know some people will really struggle with that, but I think for us as a family, that was a blessing. And, you know, it's that routine, isn't it, of having to do those things.
Sure. And the farming community as well, when things like this happen, and I get, you know, and I've certainly experienced this. Our next door neighbor took his own life a couple of years ago, and a very close family friend, and I guess everybody listening probably knows somebody in the farming community. It does bring out the best in people, you know, and you know, everybody comes together, don't they, to help. Did you find that?
Oh, absolutely. Like the food that, I mean, there's loads of us at that house, loads of us. The food that came to the door, the cards, the donations towards charities for mental health, just all of those things were just unbelievable. And even on the day of the funeral, you know, I'll never, ever be quite as proud as what I was on the day of the funeral when I saw my four brothers carry my sister into that church.
Yeah.
And if Cheyenne could have seen, I mean, the church was packed to the rafters, all outside the church door. There were people. She was so loved. And the community spirit that we have in our tiny village is just unbelievable. And, you know, it's just, it's overwhelming. But, you know, the boys, to say, you know, James and Joe, 15 and 17, Wayne would be 20. Yeah. You know, unbelievable how proud I am of them boys. And Thomas, but Thomas, you know, he's old, so.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. So after you lost Cheyenne and you know, such a turmoil and everything you've gone through, did you feel like you needed, I don't know, a change? Did you feel like you needed to get away from what you were doing? Did you sort of contemplate, you know, where you were going to go next?
No, change. Change accidentally happened in my life. So because we weren't milking anymore, there wasn't the same work on the farm. And all that, like, I love the farm and I love working with my dad, even though he's a pain in the ass at times. He knows that. He'll admit that. You know, he knows I'm always. He knows I'm always right in every decision I make or idea. So I was doing a few things. I was doing some dry stone walling. I was still working at home. I was working in the pub two or three nights a week. I was working for a guy foot trimming cattle. God, I was just doing an endless amount of things just to fill my time because I like to work and I like to be busy. And then I started collecting a few calves for Butelar, which is the company I work for now, but just picking them up. Like not buying them, nothing, just picking them up. And then I met Adam and he went, actually, no, Liz, I'd like you to go and buy calves. Off you go to Scotland. And I was like, right, okay. Never, I'm a dairy farmer. I've never bought a calf in my life. I've sold calves.
Yeah.
I'm probably, you know, not that good at it. But you know what? it was the break that I needed because nobody knew me. So everywhere I went, everybody knew my story. Everybody knew what had happened. You know, everybody tiptoed around you. I hate that. Like, just be straight with me. Mm-hmm. Just tell me what you think. If you've got a problem, tell me. Or if something's wrong, tell me. So I had none of that. I had farmers, you know, telling me to bugger off, get off, not interested, not going to sell you calves, not going to do this, but persevered and kept doing it because I'm so pig-headed. And actually, that was a big change in my life because it meant that for 1 or 2 days a week, I was me again. Yeah. And I wasn't, you know, Liz Hoggarth of 2016, you know, I was a different person. And yeah, you know, I'm forever grateful to Adam for giving me the opportunity to work for Beauty Lab. Even I'm not sure he gave me the opportunity. I think I probably just took over in the end. I remember him meeting my dad for the first time, and he said to my dad, "Well, it's certainly great to know who's now running the company." And my dad said, "Oh, you've got that, Liz, have you?" So yeah. He certainly thinks I'm in charge. So, and it's been brilliant. I've had great opportunities. I've worked with some absolutely brilliant farmers. I'm so blessed. Dairy farming is a tough. Farming in general is a tough industry, but it is the best in the world.
For sure. I guess just to get in that, having that tap on the shoulder and him sort of showing that faith in you and saying, "No, you can do this." I've had a couple of people through my life who've done that, and it means a lot, doesn't it, when you get that person who sort of says no, you know.
Yeah,
you might be out of your comfort zone, but I have faith that you can do it is something that's massive. I think
that's probably the most polite way that you could put it. That's certainly not what Adam said. He said, "Get your ass out there and buy some cards," and you know, that's what I need. I don't need all of that. "Well, you know, I don't think you can do this." Just tell me what you want, and I'll go and do it. And yeah, it's nice from being told at school that agriculture is not going to be a great industry. Mm-hmm. You're not going to earn a lot of money. Like, I don't earn a lot of money, don't get me wrong, but I am rich in love for my industry, and that is what fulfills me every day. I don't need thousands of pounds. I need to be happy. And there's so many people paid a lot of money that are sitting really crap jobs and they're miserable. Whereas I am so lucky. Adam pays me very minimally. I can say that, can I? So he'll listen. He will kill me for that. No, but you know what I mean. Agriculture isn't the best paid job in the world. Whatever you do, it's not. But, you know, the joy that I take from my dairy farmers and, you know, seeing calves throughout the supply chain and lots of things like the Longhorn scheme. He went, "There you go, Liz, have that." I was like, "Are you crazy?" I just want to go and buy calves. And actually, I just love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it just, I don't know. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, you're a people person. So I guess it's just meeting those different people on a daily basis.
I am a people person, and someone once told me when I was having a little bit of a wobble thinking I can't do this, you know, I'm no good at it or this and the other. They said to me, "Liz, people only work with people that they like."
Mm-hmm.
And you're working with a lot of people, so you must be quite likable. Am I? Yeah. I don't know, but I am a people person. I love meeting people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, you can tell that you love your job. I mean, anyone who sort of follows you on social media can tell that you have the massive enthusiasm for it and the people you work with. So what do you think the future holds for you, Liz? Do you want to keep doing what you're doing with your work and with the other stuff you do with trying to raise awareness of mental health issues?
Yeah, the biggest thing, my work will always be the same. I'm happy. I'm fulfilled in what I do. So I'm happy there. I don't see anything changing there anytime. I want to raise awareness of mental health. I really, really do. We are getting better at it, but I think there's still a long way to go. I think the pressures in the industry, the imbalance in supply chains throughout the industry has a big factor on that. I think if we can look at those things, I think there's a lot going on with dairy contracts that will hopefully bring a bit more balance to this, to the dairy supply chain. And I hope that that will be rolled out into other supply chains. It does have a huge factor on mental health. And I want people, I want the general public to engage with us. We need to engage with them, because a lot of the time we chat to each other, don't we? Yeah. We tell each other what we're doing.
Yeah.
But we need to be, like, my village is teeming with visitors, absolutely teeming. But does anybody engage with them? No. Mr. Angry Farmer is peed off because Joe Bloggs is doing 20 miles an hour with his caravan on the back. Well, Mr. Angry Farmer was doing 15 miles an hour yesterday, you know, moving around Vale. So we need to engage and, you know, involve people.
Hmm. I think we're slowly getting better at it, aren't we? But, you know, at least, as again, you know, the fact that we're having these conversations and talking about that, I think is a positive step forward, isn't it, in that debate?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Okay. So you've taken the decision lately as a family to move on from the family farm. Probably the biggest decision that farming families can ever make, I guess. Tell me why the decision came about.
Well, I really want, so Dad was 63 in February, and I really wanted Dad to retire when he was 60, because I thought, what? So none of the boys are interested. I'm the only one that's really interested. I'm 41. So for me to start something now that we really don't know where this is going to go, mm-hmm. you know, over the next 10 years, with single farm payment and things, I thought, I'm happy in my job. I don't want to give up my job.
Yeah.
So Dad decided, I think he initially thought he would do another year, but I think he's feeling tired. Losing my sister has really taken its toll on him, you know. Yeah. So there's lots he wants to do. Like he's got motorbikes. He just bought himself another motorbike. So he's quickly spending mine and the boys' inheritance on motorbikes. And, you know, and he's been to a pre on his motorbike. He wants to tour Europe. So, you know, and like I say, I'm 41. It's not, I can't do it on my own. Do I want to do it? I would love to do it. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's time for another young family to take the farm. And good friends of my dad and my stepmom's lost their son a few years ago, and he'd work with us all summer, so silaging and hay time. And it's his elder brother who is going to rent the farm from us, and him and his wife have three young children. That's, I think, their age, six down to one, who go to the local school. You know, she spends a life in the kitchen baking cakes and selling them. She's doing Eva's birthday cake for Sunday, you know. So it's just important to us that we bring a young family in, because it would be so easy to put it out to tender and get the highest bid, and someone just, you know, take every ounce of grass off the property and not really look after it and not really benefit the village, whereas they do. So it makes perfect sense, really, for it to be a young family.
That's yeah, that's amazing. I think sort of what's come through over the last hour and however long we've been talking is that you are really good at taking difficult situations and finding the positives, and you know, that's all any of us can do, I suppose.
It's the hardest thing. It's so hard to let it go.
Yeah,
you know, like, because I have sheep. I only have a handful. You know, that are my own, but I've got to a stage where the sheep that I breed, I'm really happy to sell, and they'll need to go. And, you know, it's a different life, but we'll work together. And Tom and Katie know that us as a family will help where we can, you know, and guide them and do whatever they want to do to help them. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, it's people and family that count in the end, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So we will finish this off with the traditional hard hitting questions, if God. You're ready. That's not the response I want, Liz.
Well, you gave me these questions and I'm like, oh Lord.
They are hard. They are hard.
They're really hard. Well, some are really easy, but some are just.
What's your all-time favourite song?
Right. Well, I have two. Okay. Now
I'll allow it.
Okay. Well, you can't not allow it. So I'll just chat. I won't stop chatting. So my all-time favourite song is called Leave Out All the Rest, and it's by Linkin Park.
Okay.
And this is a song that was very, very prominent in my mind when I was struggling with postnatal depression. And I actually have one of the lyrics tattooed on my side. People who know I like my tattoos.
Yeah.
And the other one is Caruso by Pavarotti.
Linkin Park and Pavarotti. Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. So there you go. I love everything. I love, like, I was brought up with Dire Straits, Pink Floyd, Muddy Waters, all of those people, you know, with my dad. Brought up in the 80s, so, yeah. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a hard one. The Olympics is just finished. Which sport in the Olympics, right? You have to choose one sport. Would you back yourself to do best at, do you think, watching them all?
One single one of them.
It's got to be, like, the BMX, hasn't it? After your childhood days?
Well, yes, but no, because I'm too... I don't weigh what I did when I was seven, for one thing.
None of us do.
Yeah, BMX, but actually, yeah, well, no, you're probably right. It would be BMX or football for me. But I just, look, the only good thing I'm good at now with sport is railroading other people into doing things so that I can raise money for charity, which is what we saw with Run 1000.
So, oh yeah, okay, so maybe you could be one of the team coaches.
Maybe. And that will probably be best.
All right.
An inspirational speaker.
All right, then. When you were a teenager, who did you have posters of on your bedroom wall?
Brian Robson,
the footballer. Wow.
So my uncle worked at Old Trafford, and he used to play cricket with some of the players. I don't know. And I just loved Brian Robson. Brian Robson and Steve Bruce. Now, he used to get free tickets to Old Trafford. So yeah, I'd be like ringing, Uncle Dom, can I have the tickets this week? You know, and I'd go and watch them. And I just, yeah. So Man United footballers and England footballers. I used to love football. I don't really have the love now of football, but it's a different game. So.
Okay. All right. Okay, that's a really good answer. That could have been a lot more embarrassing. I think most of us have sort of cheesy pop stars and things like that.
But you didn't ask me what posters I had on my wall when I was in my 20s.
come on, who was it?
Kurt Angle used to hang on my living room door.
That's it. Oh, it could have been worse. Okay. If you won 2 weeks, all expenses paid, holiday to anywhere in the world, COVID, pretend COVID's gone, where are you going?
This again, I mean, I've always wanted to go to the Middle East.
Okay.
Cool. Now, it's not that safe, is it?
Probably not at the moment.
No. Always, I don't really have great aspirations to go anywhere in particular, to see anything in particular. For me, if you said to me, right, there's 2 weeks, so this 2 weeks all-inclusive holiday, there's 10 grand, do you know what? I would take every one of my friends for a night out or two nights out, or I'd rather do that because yeah. I love seeing my friends. And we've really missed that throughout COVID. Yeah. We've not had that proper night out. And then one of them's pregnant or breastfeeding. So we don't get that. But yeah, the Middle East, there's lots of places I'd like to see, just for the scare factor, I think. The big tanks.
All right, then. Traditional way to end. What is your favourite agriculture-related social media account to follow and why?
Well, I kind of got two. Look, right, both of these guys promote agriculture in different ways. They're both extremely humble, polite, and unassuming. They say things in different ways. They don't get angry at people. They're never rude to people. One of those is James Robinson, because I think what he is creating around his farm is absolutely astounding. I've yet to go there and see him and look at it all, and you know, and I must do that. But he's just fantastic.
He is, and he's also the nicest guy in the world, James.
Yes, he is. I mean, I've spoken to him.
But yeah, I love him to bits. He's so genuine and lovely, and his whole family are actually.
Yeah, and I just and I think for what he's done, you know, around the farm, he's had quite a lot of flack off people. Mm-hmm. And do you know what? It's his farm.
Yeah.
Leave him to it.
Yeah.
And the other one is Farmer Tom, because my God, no one likes a bully. he's not scared of putting himself out there. Yeah. And he's so clever in how he does things in his videos, and he really engages with children, you know, children really. You know, warm to him. So definitely. Sorry, two again.
Gorgeous, gorgeous beard as well, Farmer Tom. I'm always jealous of his gorgeous beard. Yeah, such a good communicator. Right, Liz, thank you so much for talking about this today. I know that so much of what you do is trying to help others, and God knows we need that in the world at the moment. Need more people like you. So thank you. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. And hopefully we'll catch up soon now the world's opening up again.
Yay. Thank you. Say hi to Sarah and the girls.
I will do.
I must come and get some eggs and honey.
Yes, call in whenever you're passing. Next time you're down this neck of the woods.
We'll love to see you.
And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farm Inc. Thank you and good night.